Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
From the BBC World Service, The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
Catch up with season one of the podcast now by searching for The Lazarus Heist wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And get ready for season two coming next week.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 22nd of March, these are our main stories. A large earthquake has hit Afghanistan and has been felt as far away as the Indian capital, Delhi. President Putin has condemned the British government's decision to provide Ukraine with armour-piercing ammunition that contains depleted uranium. Swiss investigators have concluded that a family obsessed with conspiracy theories had planned their collective suicide before jumping from a seventh-floor balcony. Also in this podcast, Google launches an AI chatbot. But what are the pitfalls?
One of the big things is that these systems have a propensity to what people say is a tendency to hallucinate. Occasionally, the answers are simply factually wrong, but they sound very convincing.
A strong earthquake has struck northeastern Afghanistan, with tremors felt across a wide region, including Pakistan and parts of India. As we record this podcast, two people are reported to have been killed in the Afghan province of Lagman. The quake, with a magnitude of 6.5, was centred in the Hindu Kush Mountains. Our South Asia regional editor, Ambarisa Natarajan, told me what we know so far.
It has affected a wide area, like from Afghanistan to Pakistan, as far as India. The officials are saying that they are still verifying information from the remote areas of northwest Pakistan as well as in Afghanistan. The tremors were felt very strongly in many Pakistani cities and as well as in India. So people got panicky and they rushed to the streets and they were waiting there for more than an hour, you know, thinking there might be, you know, further tremors. But in Afghanistan, again, some of the remote areas, what a Taliban spokesperson just messaged me, Dr. Sharafat Zaman Amar, he said, "We have casualties and damages, but up to now, according to information, it's limited." They are now assessing the situation because some of these areas are very remote. Many villages do not even have, you know, telephone facility or internet facility. So in the next few hours, the situation may emerge.
And somewhere like Afghanistan, because of the situation with the Taliban, they won't have the aid that perhaps India and Pakistan have access to, especially in these really remote parts of Afghanistan.
They did struggle when a similar earthquake hit the region last year, last June. More than 1,000 people were killed in eastern Afghanistan. At that time, the Taliban were initially struggling to send aid and other materials to some of this remote southeastern part of Afghanistan. But then international aid agencies and the UN, they jumped in and they also provided aid. Again, they have to set up this disaster management units in different parts of the country. Even though the UN and other agencies are helping, but there is no organized setup. They are still setting up in various districts. The previous Afghan administration collapsed, and now the Taliban are trying to rebuild. And that is why the officials are saying that they're waiting for more information from the faraway areas of the country.
Ambarisa Natarajan. President Putin has warned that Russia will react if the UK gives Ukraine ammunition containing depleted uranium. He made the threat at a joint news conference with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, who's in Moscow. In response, Britain's Ministry of Defence said it had used armour-piercing rounds for decades. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, has more on Mr. Putin's comments.
He condemned what he said were UK plans to send Ukraine ammunition containing depleted uranium. If this happens, Mr. Putin said, Russia will be forced to react, since the collective West was starting to use weapons with a nuclear component. Depleted uranium is not a nuclear weapon. This week, Baroness Goldie, a UK Minister of State for Defence, said in a written answer to a parliamentary question that Britain would be sending ammunition, including armour-piercing rounds, which contain depleted uranium, to Ukraine. In separate comments, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said he had no doubt this would end badly for Britain.
Steve Rosenberg. As we heard in the earlier podcast, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has made an unannounced visit to Kiev to express his country's support for Ukraine against Russia's invasion. Mr. Kishida's visit coincided with that of the Chinese President Xi Jinping to Russia, David Bamford reports.
Mr. Kishida is the last of the G7 leaders to head to Kiev while the conflict in Ukraine continues. Japan is hosting the next G7 summit in May. He was taken to the nearby town of Bucha, where hundreds of civilians were killed last year by Russian forces. Mr. Kishida laid a wreath, saying he felt great anger over the atrocity that had taken place there. Tokyo has continually voiced support for Ukraine and has imposed sanctions against Moscow.
That was David Bamford. Israel's parliament has voted to allow Israeli citizens back into four settlements in the occupied West Bank, which were evacuated in 2005. The vote risks further inflaming tensions with Palestinians ahead of Ramadan. Violent clashes between the two sides have grown more frequent as Israeli settlers have become increasingly emboldened by the new nationalist coalition government. Tim Franks reports from the north of the West Bank.
At root, this conflict is incredibly simple. It's about land, and Abu Khalid's farm is right at the front line. Through his olive groves here, you can see a ring of hill ridges, and one after another, there are Jewish settlements on them. And from some of them, Abu Khalid says he's close enough to have had repeated visits in recent years, months, even weeks, from settlers, and it's been terrifying.
1 month ago, 15 to 20 settlers came to here. They are very violent. They want to destroy everything. Every night, I don't sleep from 7 p.m. till 7 a.m. In this way, I protect myself.
We've heard from Abu Khalid, now from a young man. He's asked we don't use his name or his voice. You'll hear instead just his words in translation. He works in Tumasaya. He's a 27-year-old former prisoner. He says the recent raids by the Israeli army, recent attacks by settlers, point to one thing. A massed, violent confrontation, an intifada, is coming.
The Jews, it's not our enemy inside. They not attack me. But the settlers, the Jews can't protect us from the settlers. So our enemy is the settlers.
If it came to it, do you think that you would fight?
Definitely, for sure. I will be part of it. I want to protect my land and my home, and we want to protect ourselves.
Time to head to the other side. Next to Tumasaya is the Jewish settlement of Shiloh. About 5,000 people live here, including veteran spokesman and campaigner for the settlers, Yisrael Maydad.
We have a problem with the sociological term is hilltop youth, who are not able to understand that not only what they're doing is wrong in an ethical, moral sense, but just doesn't help anybody and even hurts our cause. But there is no such thing as Jewish violence by itself. It's always in reaction. If there was no Arab terror, if there was no Arab incursions of land, there wouldn't be the irresponsible, illegal response from the Jews. But in retrospect, I'd have to say that if the world is willing to give the Palestinians a state or recognize their right or champion them, as some charities across Europe do, and on the background of all their terror, I think they could at least tolerate and understand acts of violence by a small number of Jewish youth.
Shiloh is the major settlement here, but there are also a string of smaller settlements. They're called outposts, which are officially not authorized, even under Israeli law. They're strung across this land, and we're heading up to one of them now. It's called Esh Kodesh. Generally, the smaller the place, the harder line it is. The guy I want to meet, he's called Meir Ayash. He runs security here.
People here are decent and moral, and after the Palestinians are coming, burning, and doing some bad things here, people at the end lose their patience and go back and revenge.
Do you think with this new government, in that case, that things at last are going to change?
Yeah, he said, and it will be also better for the Palestinians when they will see who is governing this place and they will understand what are the boundaries. Things will be much easier and much clearer for both sides.
That report from Tim Franks. To Switzerland now, where police say they've closed their investigation into the apparent suicide of a family last March. A father, mother, her twin sister and two children jumped from the balcony of their apartment in the city of Montreux. One of the children, a 15-year-old boy, survived but was badly injured. Swiss investigators have ruled out any outside intervention and say the family, originally from France, held beliefs which led to the tragedy. Our correspondent in Geneva is Imogen Folkes and has the details.
Almost exactly a year ago, the family of five, among them an 8-year-old girl and a 15-year-old boy, jumped one after the other from their 7th-floor apartment in Montreux. All except the teenage boy died instantly. The case shocked Switzerland and there were questions about how it could have happened, especially with children involved. Today, Swiss investigators ruled out any third party. They say there was no sign of a struggle. Autopsies revealed no trace of drugs. But analysis of the family apartment and electronic devices showed the mother of the family and her twin sister, who lived with them, were deeply involved in survivalist and conspiracy theories. After the tragedy, the apartment was found full of emergency supplies of food. The family rarely went out and the children were homeschooled. The investigation concludes this was a collective suicide planned in advance. It seems the two women really believed and persuaded the children too that the world was a hostile place and they were waiting for the right moment to leave for somewhere better. Tragically, what seems to have triggered that moment was a welfare visit from Montreux police. They stopped by that morning with a reminder about a meeting with local authorities to discuss the children's homeschooling. The family didn't let the police in and jumped off the balcony minutes later. Today, the Swiss authorities appealed for privacy for the surviving son, who was in a coma but has now recovered. Investigators say he has no memory of that day.
Imogen Folkes. Ever since ChatGPT was released last November, we've witnessed the astounding capability of artificial intelligence. With relatively simple prompts, users have asked the app to write college essays and job applications and mock up detailed photograph-like images based on text. Now, Google has joined in, launching its very own long-awaited AI chatbot to a limited number of users. And Google Bard is designed to do what Google does best, search the internet for answers. Our tech reporter is Chris Vallance.
I think the key thing about Bard is it's a conversational AI and it's very good at answering questions using natural language. So, you know, it really does the kind of things that a search engine would do, but it allows you to do it in a conversational way. And you know, in an announcement, Google has a few examples, you ask the question, what's an easy indoor plant to care for? And Google Bard actually writes you a little essay with some suggestions. Or, you know, another example from their announcement, you know, how do I get my daughter interested in fly fishing? And again, there are various suggestions, a range of suggestions written in regular prose of the kind a human being might write with answers to those questions. There are errors in some of those answers, which is interesting. Google's very keen to stress that this is an experiment. But, you know, the answers are kind of convincing and people clearly are enjoying interacting with these chatbots, which is why everybody's asking the question, is this really the future of search? Is this how people are going to want to look for information, i.e. asking a question, getting a response in sort of regular English, if you like, rather than a list?
And it sounds really impressive. Like, I love the idea about plant care because I'm terrible at killing plants. Are there any drawbacks to it?
One of the big things is that these systems have a propensity to what people say is a tendency to hallucinate. Occasionally, the answers are simply factually wrong, but they sound very convincing. You know, it's like one of your friends who knows everything and can talk very plausibly about all sorts of things. And to be honest, Google has always sort of held back on releasing its sort of AI technology. I mean, you know, Bard is based on Lambda, which was a conversational AI that Google had in development for a long time. It was so impressive that rather famously one Google employee thought it was sentient. I mean, it wasn't, but, you know, it was convincing enough that even one of their own employees thought it might have feelings. So they've been sort of working on AI technology for quite some time, doing some impressive things, but they never released it because they were concerned about various things such as bias in the system. I mean, these systems are trained on, you know, all the stuff that's out there on the internet, which obviously includes lots of things that are sort of offensive, racist, etc. And that, you know, despite their best efforts, those sorts of things can get incorporated into the models. So in a sense, the models reflect the flaws in humanity.
That was Chris Vallance. Still to come, we'll look at the new evidence on the link between the contraceptive pill and cancer.
These increases in risk for breast cancer have to, of course, be viewed in the context of what we know about the many benefits of taking hormonal contraceptives.
That's all to come after this.
Dear Daughter is a podcast from the BBC World Service, full of personal insight and thoughtful letters of advice.
Things that can inform you, can guide you, can support you.
It's a handbook to life for daughters everywhere. And we're back for season two. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcast.
Dear Daughter.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. An American trucker who spied on a dissident Irish Republican group has told the BBC that the British Security Service, MI5, did not want its leader to be arrested. David Rupert infiltrated the real IRA on behalf of the Security Service, as well as the FBI. He's been speaking about his experiences for the first time, as Jennifer O'Leary reports from Belfast.
David Rupert, a 6-foot-7 tall trucker from upstate New York, went from being a tourist enthralled to Irish history to working for the FBI and the security service MI5, infiltrating Irish Republican groups militantly opposed to Northern Ireland's fragile peace. He struck gold when Michael McKevitt, the leader of the group that admitted responsibility for the 1998 OMA bomb, the deadliest atrocity in Northern Ireland's troubles, put him on the top table of the real IRA, its ruling army council. But David Rupert's spy masters seemingly had competing priorities. The FBI wanted to build a prosecution case with the Irish police against McKevitt. Yet, according to David Rupert, MI5 wanted to keep him inside the real IRA.
MI5 wanted to keep it going forever, and the FBI won. It was more important to MI5 to have a thumb on the pulse than it is to go arrest a couple people and prosecute them. The MI5 didn't want them arrested.
The BBC put that to MI5, but they did not respond. David Rupert went on to give evidence in a Dublin court against Michael McKevitt, leading to his conviction in 2003 for directing terrorism. In all of the years of the Troubles and peace thereafter, Rupert did what few spies have ever done. He faced down an Irish Republican godfather in court.
That was Jennifer O'Leary in Northern Ireland. Next to Indonesia, and parents whose children died or were injured by contaminated cough syrup have been allowed to take the government and pharmaceutical companies to court. They're seeking millions of dollars in damages. More than 200 Indonesian children have died of acute kidney injury since last year. About 100 deaths have also been reported in the Gambia and Uzbekistan. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Valja Baraputri, a reporter for BBC Indonesia.
This lawsuit is a class action brought up by a group of 25 parents whose child either died or injured because of the cough syrup contamination that led to acute kidney injuries in their children. So they asked for compensation from the Indonesian governments and companies and pharmaceutical suppliers of almost $200,000 for every child killed and about $130,000 for every child injured. What they are actually wanting here in the class action is accountability from those parties.
So the court has ruled that this can be heard and various agents are up for potential legal action against them in Indonesia, as you say. But this does have an international element because we know that there have been similar cases in the Gambia and also in Uzbekistan where children have been affected. Where does this all come from? Why was the cough mixture so lethal in some cases?
I spoke to the Indonesian police who led an investigation on this. They found that the cause of this whole tragedy is global, which was the scarcity of the solvent material used in syrupy drugs called propylene glycol. But the crime is local. So basically, suppliers in Indonesia relabeled the industrial grade solvent material as pharmaceutical grade solvent material. And then they supply that to pharmaceutical companies or other suppliers that produce these drugs. That is the main cause of the situation in Indonesia, but they haven't found the evidence of transnational crime and whether this has links with other cases in other countries. The cause is global, but the crime is local. That's what they said.
Okay. But for the parents, I mean, the thought that you yourself gave your child something you thought would make them feel better, and actually it's what led to terrible illness or even death. I mean, that's why this must be so emotive for the parents involved.
That's true. They always come to the court wearing t-shirt that says, I thought it was medicine, but it was poison. The parents who talk to me, they all get their medicine for their children from health institutions, and they're all sick with the same cause. The Indonesian government, including the Health Ministry and Food and Drug Agency of Indonesia, have maintained their position as responsible parties in this situation. But the parents who came forward with this class action lawsuit want their accountability of why this could happen.
That was Valja Baraputri from BBC Indonesia. Scientists have found that any type of hormonal contraceptive may increase the risk of breast cancer. Millions of women across the world take some kind of birth control pill. But data about the mini progesterone-only pill had been fairly limited until now. Our health correspondent, Michelle Roberts, reports.
Experts have known for some time that the combined oral contraceptive pill, which contains two hormones, estrogen and progestogen, carries a small increased risk of breast cancer for users. It wasn't clear if the same might be true for another type of hormonal contraceptive, the progestogen-only mini pill, because there hadn't been enough data. Now researchers from Oxford University have done a big analysis to help advise women. They say the risk posed is roughly the same based on the findings from nearly 30,000 patient records. That risk equates to between 8 and 265 extra cancers occurring in every 100,000 users. One of the researchers, Professor Gillian Reeves, said women shouldn't stop taking their pill.
These increases in risk for breast cancer have to, of course, be viewed in the context of what we know about the many benefits of taking hormonal contraceptives, not just in terms of birth control, but also because we know that oral contraceptives actually provide quite substantial and long-term protection from other female cancers, such as ovarian cancer and endometrial cancer.
The tiny breast cancer risk, skewed towards older users, goes away within a few years of stopping the medication. Experts say anyone worried about breast cancer and contraception or unsure of what type they're using should talk to their doctor or family planning clinic.
Michelle Roberts. The actress Gwyneth Paltrow has appeared in court in the United States as a civil trial begins over claims she seriously injured a man in a hit-and-run skiing accident in 2016. Rachel Wright is following the case.
Gwyneth Paltrow appeared in court on Tuesday alongside her lawyer for the opening arguments in the civil trial. She's being sued by Terry Sanderson, a retired optometrist, who alleges that the actress was skiing out of control when she hit him at the Deer Valley Resort in Park City, Utah. In his opening statement, Sanderson's lawyer told the jury that Paltrow's behaviour was reckless.
Distracted skiers cause crashes. Defendant Gwyneth Paltrow
knew that looking up the mountain and to the side while skiing down the mountain was dangerous. And she knew that skiing that way, that it was not a matter of if, but when, she would crash into somebody below her and someone would get seriously and permanently hurt.
Terry Sanderson, who is 76, claims the accident caused him a brain injury, 4 broken ribs and other serious injuries, and is seeking damages of $300,000. He also alleges both Paltrow and her instructor skied away after the accident. Gwyneth Paltrow, who won an Oscar in 1998 for Shakespeare in Love, is countersuing, claiming Sanderson hit her with a full body blow. Her lawyer told the court that the charges against her were offensive. Both Paltrow and Sanderson are due to testify at the trial, which is set to last for 8 days.
Rachel Wright. About 300 million people around the world have been celebrating Nowruz, the Persian New Year. It's been observed for 3,000 years in different regions, including the Balkans, the Caucasus and the Middle East. The day marks the end of the old year and the first day of spring. And this year it took on a special significance in Iran, as Kazra Naji from BBC Persian explains.
Yes, it's a big day, Nowruz, for the Persian world and the Iranians particularly. It's like Christmas Day in the Christian world. And it's the time when families get together, they sit around the table, they eat together, they spend time together. It's the spring equinox when actually the change happens and we go into the spring. But this year, because of the problems that the country has had over the last 6 months, sweeping unrest, clampdown by the Iranian authorities, shooting at the demonstrators, we have had at least 570 people dead, many more injured, thousands arrested, many people went into hiding, some people had to leave the country. So this year, it seems the celebrations are pretty low-key. And we in the BBC Persian have been getting videos from viewers, particularly those families of people who lost their loved ones in the last 5 months, and their friends spending the time by the graveside of their loved ones.
And how are the Iranian officials dealing with this? Are they trying to make out that it's business as usual and people are still celebrating?
Absolutely. We had the Iranian leader speaking today, 1 hour, 20 minutes. In it, he speaks 13 times of either the enemy or the enemies, his favourite words, and everything is normal. Iran is in a good place. It's only the enemies who are making trouble. We're making a lot of progress in science, in technology, in irrigation, in dam building, in defence industries, in nuclear science. We're making all this progress, and it's only the enemies who are causing problem for us. But we are very strong. Who, he asked, which country could have withstood so much pressure from the international community as we have done?
That was Kazra Naji from BBC Persian. Finally, in a career spanning more than 50 years, he's notched up a string of hits, including Father and Son and Peace Train. Along the way, Cat Stevens converted to Islam, changing his name to Yusuf Islam. Now known as Yusuf Cat Stevens, he's releasing his 17th album in June, when he'll also be playing at the Glastonbury Festival in southern England for the first time in the so-called Legends slot. The singer-songwriter talked to our culture editor, Katie Razzle, about his music, his faith and performing at Glastonbury.
I met Yusuf Cat Stevens at a gallery in central London with real significance to him.
Well, I lived up there above the shop and this is where, you know, business took place.
That business was his parents' restaurant, where he often worked.
My imagination began in this place, you know, that's where I started to look beyond the sink and the mop.
As I'm being followed by a moon shadow.
At the height of his fame in the 1970s, after a long bout of tuberculosis and then a near-death experience, he walked away from pop stardom, changing his name and embracing Islam. He's promoting his latest album of 12 songs called King of a Land.
I'll take the world apart to
find a place for a peaceful heart.
And your faith leaps out of almost every song. Do you feel that now, all these years on from when you did decide to embrace Islam, Britain certainly is a much more secular country than it was even back then?
It is, but nobody loses the spirit. Nobody's lost that in Britain. Problem is, it's covered with other slush and mush and whatever. And politics. Quite honestly, I've got the answer for that anyway in this album.
What's the answer?
Lock up all the leaders in London Zoo. It's obvious.
Lock those leaders in London Zoo.
So you're blaming the politicians for the ills of the world?
Well, a lot of them, yeah.
Oh, baby, baby, it's a wild world.
Very recently, you've been announced in the Legends slot at Glastonbury. What does that mean to you, do you think?
Well, it's probably on a lot of people's bucket lists. It's probably on mine too.
Here comes my baby. Here she comes now.
Do you see yourself as a legend?
I ain't gone yet, you know. But so, I mean, legends are supposed to be things that after they're gone, you know. But I reckon so.
Morning has broken like the first morning.
Will you be playing the old songs? Will you be playing some of the new album as well? Have you decided?
My catalogue, you know, it's enormous. I mean, having to choose is the problem. But I've got a lot of advisors, and, you know, and my brother the other day said, don't forget Hard-Headed Woman. I go, yeah, you're right, that's a good one.
I'm looking for a hard-headed woman, headed woman.
And, of course, Wild World and things like that, Father and Son.
How can I try to explain?
First Cut is the deepest. Some people still don't know that I wrote it. It wasn't Rod Stewart.
The first cut is the deepest.
And in one of your songs on the album, How Good It Feels, you say, I know what it's like to be misunderstood.
What it's like to be misunderstood.
And I know that you said you were misunderstood over your comments around Sir Salman Rushdie and the fatwa. But I wondered, you know, he has been recently attacked. What you thought when you heard about that attack?
Yeah, I was horrified because misunderstood is exactly what I was. I never supported the fatwa and I went to as much length as I could go to explain myself, but nobody wanted to print that side of the story. And, you know, and I had to, you know, live with that. And I think a lot of it was basically political. And I'm not a political animal. I'm not.
That was the singer Yusuf Cat Stevens talking to our culture editor, Katie Razzle. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Cazares. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.